was dignified and people, because that's really something that we've really worked hard to try and do in terms of our operation in Greece. So if I just to go back a bit, I mean, this was a camp called Idomeni. This is on the northern border of Greece, and this is where many, many thousands of people, tens of thousands, crossed into the rest of Europe. And in March 2016, that's what it looked like. The borders closed in about December, so many people had been there for about 4 years. There was about 12,000 living in those kinds of conditions. Absolutely dreadful. And that's when we arrived in Greece. At the end of March, there was a deal. And the deal was that Greece would keep people in camps. They'd move them away from Idomeni, and then they created camps. And so this was the first camp we went to. And they put people in tents. This is the back entrance. The front entrance was here. This is a small town. And that's very typical of the refugee camps in Greece. They'd be stuck in what was a derelict military camp, which would normally be on the edge of town or some way out of town. And that's much what and that's what it looked like. So very little, very difficult. And we arrived there at the beginning of April and said, "Can we help, please?" Because the army was struggling. And they said no to begin with. And then after some gentle persuasion, really just a promise to try and help them, they allowed us to come in and support what they were doing. And they were fantastic. I should have to say that the Greek people that we've dealt with and the army that we've dealt with have been brilliant. Here's one of the first buses that arrived from Idomeni, and they picked people up from that camp on the border. And what you can see there is people carrying everything that they own. I'm going to point to this person here. I'm going to call her Zara. And so Zara's got four kids. One of them was a baby she was carrying, university educated, spoke fluent English. That's everything she learned. So she made that journey, and that's everything. And she's not with her husband, because her husband, like so many of these families, had gone on ahead. He's a civil engineer. He had found refuge in a northern European country. Then the borders shut, and so they were separated. And that's what she had. So we can go forward one slide. I mean, there she is with her kids. This was after about a year on the camp, on the left there. So the kids have got older. But this is where she was staying to begin with. You know, here's the three kids. They were sleeping in that tent. Because there was five of them, they had that tent to themselves. But to begin with, there were two families sharing that tent, and all that would have been divided them would have been a canvas curtain, one on the front, one on the back. Really bleak to begin with. And so, if we can just move forward, this is my colleague John. And John and I have been working in Calais. And Calais was another similar kind of squalid camp, right in the northern part of France, where many people had gone in an attempt to cross the channel from France into the UK. And so it was pretty much everyone there wanted to go to England. And John and I had been working there for about 6 months, and trying to distribute stuff in Calais was very difficult because, during that winter there was about, let's say, 10,000 people. We were running a warehouse outside the camp, so we would load up a van, a big van with, let's say, coats. We'd order them small, medium and large. We'd drive into the van with a team of about 8 people, park up somewhere, open the back of the van, and then the 8 of us would do our best to keep an orderly line and distribute the coats. So someone would press the front of the line and say, "What's your size?" They would say, "Medium." We would say, "There's your medium coat, now please go." And the next person. It was one way of getting coats into the camp, but it was awful. People didn't have a choice. Often this was during the winter, it would be raining, it would be cold. The vulnerable didn't get anything. People who didn't want to queue up didn't get anything either. And I don't blame them, I wouldn't want to either. And of course, you know, some people would jump in, there'd be a bit of pushing and shoving, and it was often the case that it would become a bit of a bundle before we could get all the codes out. So we thought, when we go to Greece, we want to try and do this differently. And it was possible because we were on a settled official refugee camp where we knew everybody. And we just on the left there, we stood outside the first shop that we created. And so we thought we're going to do things. We're going to make sure everyone gets the same. We're going to be, you know, it's going to be fair. We're going to try and make it calm and respectful, and we're going to be consistent. So we promise to do something, we will deliver on it. And then out of that, you know, it became clear after say a couple of months of doing it that what we were doing was offering dignity and normality, and then. But everything else that we did following that, we really focused on that because that was the most important thing. Move forward. Yeah. And then, so the first thing we did was a free shop. It started like that. It was an empty room. The colonel of the camp, I remember he said, because we said, oh, we want to help, we want to do a shop. He said, you can do a shop, but you're not going to put a single screw in any of my walls. You'll see later how many screws we put in. It was a lot, and that was just trust. You know, I mean, he didn't want to see people suffering, and you know, we, by being every day, delivering, working hard, he trusted us more and more, and in the end, he just gave us a free rein to do whatever we wanted to. So, next slide. This is what it looked like to begin with. This is what it looked like for about the first 6 months. And what you see here is it was a space, so it was dignified in the sense that one family at a time would come in, we'd shut the door, we'd check their ID, because obviously there were some people who would like to come in two or three times during the week. And you know, I mean, that was always a bit of fun as far as I was concerned, but what we didn't want to do was create conflicts on the camp. And that would happen if people thought that they were getting more than they were. So we would have stuff on the shelves, people would come in, there would be a standard basket of stuff. So here's your size family, so you're going to get, this is how much fruit you're going to get, milk, these are like croissants, and then there was things like biscuits, tea, coffee, flour. So it was real basics. And in fact, in the beginning, they weren't allowed to cook either, so it was really kind of, you know, food that they could eat straight away. So it was a standard basket of goods, and it was, and we did stuff by, you know, like we'd load up a wheelbarrow. You know, when watermelon season came in, we went around and distributed watermelons in a wheelbarrow, tent to tent. And then sometimes we distributed other things, so we had some toys at one point. One of the hardest things I've ever done, because we didn't have enough, we had, you know, we had to do it fairly, so we thought, okay, we'll do one toy per child. Anyone who's taken any child toy shopping will know how difficult that is. But they didn't really have toys to begin with, and then they did. So, you know, we had a few kids rolling around on the floor screaming, but you see that Toys R Us around the road. So I'm going to move forward. Thank you. So, and then what we did was, I mean, that was great to begin with, but it wasn't dignified because it was still a handout, and we'd get all kinds of arguments. So people would say, I don't like normal oil, I want olive oil. We thought, well, we can't do olive oil for everyone because it's three times the price. Some people would say, I don't like coffee, I want to drink tea. Can I swap the coffee for the tea? We'd say, no, everyone's getting coffee, so you're getting coffee. And then we thought, well, we need to get away from all of that. So it's less like charity. But remember as well, we're a volunteer organisation, so the volunteers who are coming over, some of them are quite young, 21, 22. I mean, lovely, lovely people, and I'll talk about that. But, you know, there's a real power dynamic where, you know, 21, 22-year-olds checking IDs, saying you can or can't have it, to people who were, you know, heads of their family, running businesses. It was not easy. So what we did, we went to a point system, and we said, every adult has 100 points, every child has 50, every pregnant woman has 150, an adult and a child, right? And then every item in the shop had a points value. And then so the family would come in, say, okay, two adults, three children, 350 points. go and buy all you want with your 350 points. What that meant was we could stock you with anything that they wanted, tobacco, alcohol, anything else, including Pringles. Do you have Pringles here? Pringles. I mean, some people might call them junk food, but our view was if that's what they want to spend their money on, then that's what they can do. Who are we to judge what they should be, shouldn't be buying? But we always subsidise fruit and vegetables, so we make that cheaper. We do things like this, so they can weigh their own fruit and veg. And it's about trying to get as normal as possible, and always with smiley volunteers. So that was kind of the first leap in dignity. And then what we did then was we went to
tokens. And
they look a bit like that. And what we do is, it's the same principle. Everyone has, adults have 100 points and kids have 50. And once a week we distribute the money. So we give them the money that we printed to the families on the camps. And then what that meant was that they could come in whenever they wanted. They didn't have to come in on Tuesday afternoon. They didn't have to spend all their points. And the lovely thing about that is that you do get, kids coming in because mum sent them down to go and get some eggs that they've got. It's become much more normal, like the corner shop. And then we went, we've worked on six camps now. We're currently on three camps. And the shop you see on the left there is on one of the bigger camps where we currently are. And it's kind of taking design to a new level. And this was the shop that you might have seen on the video there, where people could come in. It looks nice. And this is inside that building. It's a long, thin kind of you call them Quonset huts, like a semicircular, long military style building. And there's a corridor all down one side, which we've decorated like this. And this is one of the lovely things, is that we had a couple of volunteers who were artists, and they said, we can paint this up. And this is what's happened over the last 2 years, is that John and I gave up work, John gave up at retirement to try and do something. I thought it was just going to be the two of us. I thought it would be me and John running to the supermarket and back, trying to give out a bit of food. And what happened was all these people turned up. We've had 600 volunteers now from 40 countries, and every single one of them has added a little bit more. And sometimes they come with talents like painting. And that was done in cooperation with people on the camp. Sometimes they're really good at doing kids' activities. Sometimes they're just brilliant in the shop, or they've come up with an idea of, why don't we make these labels smarter? All these little tiny improvements. These are the clothes shops in that same camp, and they're themed as well. So this is the women's boutique, we call it. Behind here is a changing room with a mirror. These are all well-sorted clothes, flowers. These are hung in bird boxes. There's a bird theme to that one. This is a kids' boutique, which is more of a kind of playful theme. The one on the left there is the men's boutique, which has got a sort of car mechanic type theme to it, so it's more rough and ready. And on the right there is a warehouse, and you can see all these crates here. Most of the clothes we got came from Greece, and pretty much all the clothes we handed out have been second-hand clothes. But as I'm sure you can appreciate, some people often use that as an excuse to kind of empty their cupboards of clothes they don't want. So there was a huge operation sitting behind this, sorting through the clothes. I reckon about two-thirds of the clothes that we got, we throw away. Dreadful waste. And it's also the same for clothes that got shipped from, we've had some from Germany and the UK. Some are better than others, so they've been quality controlled before they get there. But it's never, in the beginning it was really important to get clothes out, but as time's gone on, it's just more and more problematic. One of the most important things for us, as well as helping the refugees out, was to try and support the local economy. You might know that Greece has been suffering with economic austerity for about 8 or 9 years. It's really been on its knees economically. And then because of their geography, remember that map, you know, the first country that people got to from Turkey was Greece. And then the rest of Europe said, well, you're going to have to, you know, you're stuck with them because we don't want them. And so Greece was really trying to pick up the burden from a broken union. And what we didn't want to do was, again, import stuff from other countries. We wanted to spend money locally so that we could support Greece as well as the refugees. And of course, the other benefit of that is that it helps to ease any tensions between the communities. You know, that photo that I showed you of that first camp with the camp right on the edge of the small town. You know, that's a town of 10,000 people that's got its own problems. It's quite isolated, quite rural, and quite poor. And then they can see these refugees getting something. We, you know, here's our local Greek grocer from one of the camps, from one of our lovely volunteers. And you know, we spent a lot of money with local Greek businesses, and that's always been really important. Talk a little bit about the conditions on the camp. I mean, I think they definitely improved. So on the left there, you can see what it was like when we first arrived, because they were, you know, Greece wasn't ready. They were hoping that everyone would just move on to Germany, and then they were told to settle them on these camps. These tents either came from the army or from the UNHCR, the UN Refugee Agency. So that was the initial housing that people had, because it was a derelict camp. That's all water there, because it was a derelict camp. And it rains a lot in Greece in April and May, and so it frequently flooded. And there's some dreadful kind of, like, you know, because everyone's stuff was in the tent, and it just got all, it was horrible, it got wet and dirty.
Were they heated?
No, but it was actually. So they were in tents from when they arrived in April through to November when they moved into these things here. So, but the problem, I don't know if you've ever been in a tent during the summer, because it rains a lot in April, but it gets incredibly hot in July and August. Really, really. So it was impossible to sit. You couldn't sit in that tent during the middle of the day. So everyone was out. You know, and it's just not—it's crowded. It's just not dignified. You know, they're stuck next to people they haven't chosen to live with. And you know, here's how they wash. So this is, you know, for the first 6 months, this is how people wash. Women, because it was women, wash the clothes. And here's, you know, where they wash their hands, wash their dishes. These would be the toilets, the restrooms. And the showers would be in, and something like that as well. And just as an indication of how crazy it was here, so this was up for 6 months. The whole of that 6 months they talked about putting shade over it because it's hot and sunny in the summer. Never got around to it. And then the colonel came to us and said, I need to put a step along here so that the kids can stand up and wash their hands. It's important for hygiene reasons that they can wash their hands. And they can't reach this sink without a step. Can you put in a step? He came to us and said, it costs $200. Why? I mean, so the Greek army was coming to us to spend $200. It was that kind of crazy. There was no budget for it. So they have now moved into these homes. They've got two bedrooms, kitchen, where they can cook. They've got a shower and a toilet. And that's pretty much like that all over Greece. Some people still are in tents, unfortunately, on the islands. Some of those are a bit broken in places, but that's pretty much where people are. And then if they're not on a camp, then there are, let's say, about 25,000 living in apartments and hotels. They tend to be the more vulnerable people. And they started growing gardens, getting a bit more settled there. So things have improved in terms of the conditions where people live. I think but one of the problems is this kind of less visible. So to begin with, you know, this is this is what it was, you know, like, so here's this guy, his tent's flooded out. So this is early on, he's in a tent. It's the same guy here. He's just on the, he was on a camp by himself with his daughter, who was about three. And don't know the story of the rest of the family, but we can only assume that it's tragic. And you know, the conditions are really bad, but what we've seen over the last 2 years is the toll that it takes on people's mental health. You know, there's despair. And you know, while you know, you see plenty of people laughing and joking and having a good time, and the boys playing football and you know, the kids playing together, and the men and the women chatting, because they're people and they're strong and resilient. Every now and again, you get an insight into how bleak it is for people to be stuck on a refugee camp. So that's one. And the other is just having no control. This was a protest on one of the camps about a month ago. And what's happened over the last 2 years is many of those agencies have left the camp. So there were lots of agencies that it took them 3 or 4 months to arrive, but then they arrived and they tried to help. And then their funding dried up. And then they left. And so, I mean, these guys are really protesting about the lack of medical care, but, you know, the kids still aren't going to school. So, you know, something like 45% of the refugee population is going to be kids under the age of 16. And it's on very few camps where the kids going to school. In amongst that, it's been great to be part of a small organisation, because you know, it's chaos. The thing is always changing, always moving, and the needs always changing as well. So you know, just two of us, we can make decisions really quickly. One, you know, it's really nice to be able to you know, put in technology. So we've got this, you know, iPad with an app, so that when people come to the shop, you know, we can record what people buy, and it adds up their points. And then the other benefit is that we, you know, we can understand what, you know, what people are buying. So it's mostly dairy, fresh fruit and veg. Mostly dairy because yogurt is a huge hit. And again, you know, we know what people want, so that's what we can provide. And actually, when you look at this thing, I mean, sugar, we get through an amazing amount of sugar, and it's just a kind of arrow thing, I think, to get through loads and loads of it. It's a shame because most of them have got their teeth falling out, but anyway, that's what we want to spend weeks. Apart from that, the rest of it is pretty healthy stuff. You mentioned earlier about the tents and whether they had heating in them. When they moved people into the ISA boxes in November, they had heating units, but they hadn't upgraded the electricity system for the camp. So, people were in these, you know, they were like these rooms, and it was great. One woman said, she said to her, you know, this is better, isn't it, than a tent? You know, even though it was just a single room. And she said, yes, at least now, you know, we can keep the rats out. And I thought, oh God, that's where it's at. But it was November, in the end of December, it got down to minus 13. Degrees centigrade, which is probably around like 5 or 10 degrees Fahrenheit. Very, very cold, and no heating. And people were saying we're creating fires in their homes using plastic. I thought, oh, you know, someone's going to die either in a fire or of the cold. So we went out and bought one of these gas heaters. Every caravan, for all 80 caravans, and supplied them with the gas, and couldn't afford it at the time, but just felt like we had to do that. And of course, people jumped in to help, and we explained what we were doing, because no one else was going to do it. I mean, it was a lot of fun in some ways, because the camp said no one's allowed to have gas, because for some reason they can't trust people. I don't know what they thought, they were going to make a bomb or something with it. But so what we did is we, this is from a local supplier. We got them to park at the back of the camp, and then we smuggled the gas in using the people from the camp to distribute. And the government got in touch and said, you need to get rid of all that gas to the colonel. And the colonel, to his credit, because we didn't admit it, and he didn't accuse us, but everyone knew it was us. And the colonel said, he said to the government, as people's homes, you give me a warrant, and I'll come do it. But unless you give me a warrant, I won't. And so it continued, and it continued. We did it for about 6 weeks until another agency took it over. I think that's part of being a small organisation. When there's a real need, you just jump straight in and deal with it. Until some of the larger agencies get time to get their budgets sorted. Built a couple of playgrounds. So this one's to start with, like a soccer pitch there as well. And then in the second one, we went with full rubber matting and all the kind of business, but this is good quality stuff. Why shouldn't it be? Unfortunately, we had a really tragic incident with a baby who was born premature and came back to the camp too early. Thought we're not going to have that again, so made sure that every new mother and new baby went and stayed in a hotel until the medical team said that they were able to come back to the camp. Pretty much all women are having C-section births there. And typically they would be going in the morning and coming back in the evening.
With a C-section?
With a C-section. And to begin with, they would be going back to a tent. They'd be going back to a tent, and unfortunately that baby died in July because the tent was, it was like an oven. And it was premature. But, it's happy stories because, that's the same child as this one here now. So that was sent to John a few weeks ago. This was a massive effort, and felt like giving up halfway, trying to put a kitchen into a refugee camp. Not allowed to have gas, health and safety, who's going to do it? We're not going to let refugees have sharp knives, crazy stuff like that. But we eventually managed to pull it off, and it was brilliant. And we started, it was in these big pots here, we were cooking about 350 to 400 meals a day, 6 days a week, with a joint refugee and volunteer team. It's like a takeaway service, so they prepare in the afternoon, cook it, and then in the evening, people would come to a hatch, and then we would serve them, and then they would take their food back to their caravans. And during the afternoon, the music was playing, volunteers and the refugees were dancing. It was a lot of fun. This is the Kurdish New Ross, which is a big deal for them. And this was Eid last year. It's Ramadan at the moment, so we do extra things. So we've been distributing dates on the camps to help them break the fast. And we're funding the Eid celebration at the end of this week on the camps as well. And so on one of the camps we've had three sheep grazing camp for the last 10 days or so to help make Eid a more special occasion. It's been a real joy to discover that there's some really big-hearted, caring, amazing people out there, and if you just give them a bit of direction, they just do amazing things, just helping and supporting. I have to say, you can see, all the volunteers you see there are women. About 80% of the volunteers are women, but they've come from, all kinds of backgrounds, and we've had, the youngest has been 15, who came with her parents, and the oldest has been 79, and from 40 different countries, and I think, volunteers, they do need a bit of steering. I've probably lost quite a lot of hair just dealing with people who've come with massive energy and expectation. You've got to say, look, just chill, relax. We're not going to solve all these problems in a month, let alone a day. But is here, because, you know, like, dignity, normality, respect, all of these things are really important, but, you know, if I'm really to boil it down, you know, what's the most important thing we can do? And I think it is standing by people at a very difficult time in their lives and bearing witness to what is probably one of the biggest humanitarian crises in Europe ever, and definitely since the Second World War. Yeah, 8,000, I reckon 8,000, many of these 8,000 refugees would be for over a year as well. So, 12 shops, kind of volunteers, lots of other stuff. Let's talk briefly about Bangladesh. Now, I don't know how many of you know, but in August last year, in response to an attack on some Burmese police outposts, there was a huge retaliation from the Burmese military on the Rohingya people. Now, the Rohingya people are what they call a stateless people in Rakhine State near the Bangladesh border. What that means is they're not recognised as Burmese, so they've been persecuted for generations, even though they've been living there for many, many centuries. So it was a huge reaction to that, which was, well, the Burmese government deny it, but beyond a shadow of a doubt, there was mass killing, mass rape, and huge atrocities against the whole people. So that was in August, and something like a million then crossed the border from Burma into Bangladesh. In a very short space of time, we arrived in November and found a small camp. I say small, it was 6,300 people, and it was in no man's land. It was between Burma and Bangladesh. And because of its lack of a legal status, wasn't getting the same support as the other camps. So, in each one of these 2,000 and something bags is fresh fruit and vegetables, which we distributed with the help of the community leaders on that camp. And I mean, they had nothing, and you know, I mean, they suffered some appalling abuses. The human spirit is an amazing thing. You know, just to see that there was no fighting over this. It was all orderly and respectful. It was great. We set up an antenatal clinic. Starts off as an antenatal clinic, but there are all kinds of medical needs there. So it ended up being a medical clinic. We worked in cooperation with a local Bangladeshi medical NGO. This was fun. It's quite cold at night, and you know, the people are sleeping in bamboo huts with canvas type roofs, and you know, they fled even less than the Syrians had. So we got warm jackets for about 2,000 kids, manufactured from a local factory, exactly, so all brand new. And again, trying to support Bangladesh is even more problematic there than it is in Greece, and that's because, you know, Bangladesh is incredibly poor. There are a million of these who arrived in the space of about 6 weeks, and they really had nothing. And so the results of that were that food prices went up for the local people, wages went down because there was suddenly a surplus of labour, people who were willing to work for even less, and there was huge environmental problems as well. So because people wanted to build houses and have firewood, you know, they chopped down the forest. You know, Bangladesh is already a floodplain, so it made it even worse. So we did also buy bags for the local school and employed local people. So I'm really pleased with what we managed to do there for 4 months. We were there from November until February. But then the Bangladeshi government made it very difficult for us, basically. It was a visa thing, quite technical, but they would only allow us to be there for 30 days. We had to leave the country, and then after doing that two or three times, they said you can't keep keep doing this. And, you know, Bangladesh isn't a kind of volunteer type place. You know, we need people who can deal with, unfortunately, kind of people who've got massive trauma and, you know, people regularly dying around them as well. Yeah, just briefly, last couple of slides. On this, you know, voyage of trying to offer what we call aid with dignity, you know, which started off as a kind of standard basket, and then it was like points, and then it was money. You know, giving people money and asking them to come to the shop, it's still a handout, it's still charity. And, it, you know, those things, I think, worked pretty well for what was needed at the time. We've been there 2 years now, and some of those people in those camps are likely to be in Greece for a bit longer, quite a bit longer. And we think that the way to go is to try and get them into employment. Got big problems, you know, lots of barriers in terms of doing that. But, you know, things that we're working on at the moment is a bicycle repair and sales service on one of the camps. It's a big university town. It's nice transferable skills. It's something that people can learn quickly. Something that, you know, that will make money, and then we can pay people to work there. Any other things? Hijab manufacture. I don't know if any of you, this is the case here, but in the UK now, quite a lot of non-Muslim women are wearing hijabs because it's a fashion thing, but also to show solidarity. And it's a big market. I mean, even in Greece, it's a big market. So that's what we're thinking. Everything we've done has been as a result of private donations. And that's, so we don't get anything from government, large organisations, it's all been privately funded. And actually 40% of the money's come from volunteers. So we don't tell them they have to. We explain what we do and how important it is, and they raise money. But, you know, I go back, I'm mostly based in the UK, so I'm in the UK for about 4 weeks, and I go to Greece for about 2 weeks and give my colleague John a break. And every time I go back, there's a completely new bunch of volunteers, and that's because, you know, we only have volunteers come for 2 to 4 weeks. But I know that every time I come back, there's going to be a team like this, fantastic, hard-working, smiley, caring, big-hearted people. And, you know, this has been one of the greatest things for me, because, you know, I got into this because I was shouting at the telly. I couldn't deal with all of that misery going on. I was seeing all this stuff and talking to people, and they didn't really care. And now I've spent the last couple of years working really hard, but insulated from it. I'm in a bubble where I'm with people who care as much as I do about doing something really special. And the other thing as well is, you know, it's off the news now. It'd be great, you know, for people to continue to be aware that there's people out there who do need support. And it's not like they don't need charity. You know, they need to be given a chance. And they are strong, resilient, resourceful people. Given an opportunity, we'll all benefit. Well, I'm sure that's not news to you guys, but it can't be said enough. Thank you very much.